You ever sit in the cockpit of an airplane that was trying to kill you? Not because something broke, not because the weather turned, because the people who built it wanted you dead. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because the story of Robert A. Hoover is one of those tales that sounds like somebody made it up, except every word of it is true. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. Now, let me set the scene. It's February of 1944. Bob Hoover is 22 years old, a fighter pilot out of Nashville, Tennessee, flying Spitfires with the 52nd Fighter Group in the Mediterranean Theater. He's already got a reputation as a natural, the kind of pilot who makes the airplane do things the engineers never imagined. But on this particular day over the south of France, his luck runs dry. His Spitfire takes hits. Engine quits. He ditches in the Mediterranean and gets fished out by the Germans. They send him to Stalag Luft 1, a prisoner of war camp near Barth, Germany, right on the Baltic coast. Now, most men in that situation would hunker down, wait for the war to end, keep your head low and survive. That was the smart play. Bob Hoover was not wired for the smart play. He tried to escape. Not once, not twice, multiple times. Every time they caught him, they threw him in solitary, weeks in the dark, reduced rations. The Germans figured they would break him. They did not know who they were dealing with. Now here's where it gets interesting. On his final escape, close to the end of the war, Hoover and a fellow prisoner managed to slip out of the camp during the confusion of the German retreat. The Eastern Front was collapsing, guards were disappearing, chaos everywhere. And Bob Hoover, starving, wearing rags, barely 110 pounds on a frame that normally carried 160, does what only a pilot would do. He finds a German airfield. And sitting on that airfield is a Focke Wulf 190. Now think about this for a second. He has never sat in a Focke Wulf 190. He has never read the manual. Every label in that cockpit is in German. The instruments are metric, the throttle moves in the opposite direction from what he is used to. And he is so weak from starvation that he can barely climb up onto the wing. But he is a pilot, and pilots figure things out. He gets into that cockpit, he finds the fuel selector, he finds the starter, he fires up that BMW 801 radial engine, 14 cylinders of German engineering coughing to life on a cold morning. The sound alone must have been something. That big radial barking and then settling into a rumble. He taxis out, feeds in the power, and gets airborne. A starving American prisoner of war, stealing an enemy fighter and flying himself to freedom. He headed south toward the Allied lines. Now imagine what that flight was like. He is alone, no radio contact with anyone friendly, no charts. He is navigating by dead reckoning over enemy territory in an enemy airplane. Every anti-aircraft battery between Barth and the Netherlands is going to shoot at a Focke Wulf because they assume it is hostile, and every Allied battery is going to shoot at a Focke Wulf because they know it is hostile. He was getting shot at from both sides. He made it. He crossed the lines, put the airplane down on a field controlled by the Allies, and walked away from the Focke Wulf 190 as a free man. The whole episode sounds like a Hollywood script, except Hollywood would have made it less dramatic because nobody would believe it. But that escape, as extraordinary as it was, is just the prologue, because what Bob Hoover did after the war is what made him a legend. He became a test pilot. He flew chase for Chuck Yeager on the day Yeager broke the sound barrier in the Bell X-1 on October 14, 1947. Hoover was right there in a Lockheed P-80 Shooting Star, keeping pace, watching history happen through his canopy. He was supposed to fly the X-1 himself. He had been selected, but the night before an earlier test flight, someone stole his car from a bar parking lot. He chased the thief on horseback, fell off the horse, and broke his ribs. The X-1 flight went to Yeager instead. That is the kind of luck Bob Hoover had. He made his own when it mattered, and the universe took it away when it didn't. He went on to become North American Aviation's chief production test pilot. He flew the F-86 Sabre, the F-100 Super Sabre, the T-28 Trojan. He wrung out airplanes fresh off the assembly line, finding the problems before the military pilots did, and he was spectacular at it. Not just competent. Artists paint, sculptors carve. Bob Hoover flew. But it was the airshow circuit where the world really met him. For decades, Hoover performed in a yellow Rockwell Shrike Commander, a twin-engine business airplane about as aerobatic as a school bus, except in his hands it danced. He would shut down both engines, feather both propellers, and fly a complete aerobatic routine. Loops, rolls, 8-point rolls, all on dead engines. Then he would glide down, pour a glass of iced tea on the Glenshore, and land, all without restarting. The tea never spilled. Let me say that again, because it deserves repeating. He would pour a glass of iced tea during a dead stick aerobatic maneuver, and the tea would not spill. That is not stick and rudder skill. That is something beyond skill. That is a man who has become part of the airplane. Jimmy Doolittle, who knew a thing or two about flying, called Hoover the greatest stick and rudder pilot who ever lived. Not one of the greatest. The greatest coming from Doolittle. That is not small talk. That is a verdict. The air show routine was poetry. He would start with the engines running, do a few passes, then shut one down, then the other. The crowd would hear the props go quiet, and then silence, except for the wind over the wings. And in that silence, Hoover would fly that commander through maneuvers that most pilots would hesitate to attempt in a purpose-built aerobatic machine with a full-power engine screaming. He did this for 40 years. 40 years of air shows from the 1950s into the 1990s. Thousands of performances. Never bent an airplane. Never scratched a wingtip. The precision was almost inhuman. And then the FAA took his medical certificate away. In 1992, two FAA inspectors attended one of his air shows in Oklahoma. They decided that Hoover, who was then in his early 70s, was showing signs of cognitive decline. They pulled his medical. Now here's what you need to understand. Hoover had just flown a flawless air show routine. The airplane was fine. The performance was fine. The crowd was fine. Two bureaucrats decided that a man who had been flying for 50 years, who had escaped a German prison camp in a stolen fighter, who had chased the X-1 through the sound barrier, who could pour iced tea in a dead stick loop, was unfit to fly. Hoover fought back. He went to the National Transportation Safety Board. He went public. He had himself examined by independent physicians who found nothing wrong. The aviation community rallied behind him like nothing I have ever seen. Pilots, astronauts, test pilots, airline captains, everyone who knew what flying was stood up and said, "You were wrong about this man. It took 2 years." The FAA reinstated his medical in 1994 after intervention that went all the way up to the administrator's office. He went back to the airshow circuit and kept flying. He flew his last airshow in 2000. He was 78 years old, still sharp, still smooth, still pouring iced tea. The whole medical episode left a scar on the community. Not just because of what they did to Hoover, but because of what it revealed. Here was the finest pilot most of us would ever see, grounded by paperwork, while his skills were still beyond anything the inspectors could comprehend. It raised questions about pilot aging and medical certification that we are still arguing about today. Bob Hoover passed away on October 25, 2016. He was 94, right up to the end. The man was lucid, sharp, and telling stories that would make your jaw drop. The aviation world lost something that day that we will not get back. There is no one else. There will not be another Bob Hoover. You know what I think about sometimes? I think about that morning on the German airfield, a skinny kid from Tennessee, half-starved, climbing into a machine built by the enemy, with no manual and no plan beyond survive. He trusted his hands. He trusted his instincts. He trusted the airplane even though it was a stranger, and that trust carried him home. That is what flying is, when you strip everything else away. It is trust. Trust in the machine. Trust in your training. Trust in yourself. Bob Hoover had more of that than anyone who ever lived. Most of what I shared today comes from Hoover's own autobiography, Forever Flying, and from Mark Daniels' documentary film about his life. Both are worth your time if you have not found them yet. I'm Tail Dragger. You can find more at RadioHanger.com. Now go fly something.